This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we speak to two Iranian-American Cal Poly students about how the U.S.-Iranian tensions have impacted their daily school lives.
As Iranian-Americans, we are sometimes looked at to be native informants almost as educators, even though that's not our role. Our role is not to educate you on this complex history of the Middle East.
We'll also speak to NPR host Steve Inskeep, whose new book chronicles the history of Jesse and John Fremont and the rather large roles they played in California history.
Fremont is the guy, as a mapmaker, who gave the name to the Golden Gate.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, January 27th, 2020. I'm Tyler Pratt. Tensions between the U.S. and Iran ramped up at the beginning of this year when the United States killed a major Iranian general, and then Iran retaliated with an attack on a U.S. base in Iraq. But do the headlines and the commentary surrounding them truly reflect the issues at hand? And how is the conflict affecting Iranian people and Iranian Americans here? To help unpack some of these issues, Iranian students at San Luis Obispo's Cal Poly are hosting a panel with experts on the history of tensions between the two countries, and they are inviting the local community to attend. I recently sat down with Tara Faraji and Tisa Taranchi, two Cal Poly third-year students and leaders in the Iranian Student Cultural Organization, also called ISCO. They spoke with me about the event, what they hope people will take away from it, and what ISCO aims to accomplish.
We are a non-political, non-religious organization. Basically, we want to promote like a family feel, like a home away from home almost, for Iranian Americans and for allies to us. So we meet every Friday and we just come together. We do cultural events like Farsi lessons. We talk about like stereotypes in our communities, etc. And then we also do social events, like we do bonfires, we have parties, we have like a celebration for Nowruz, which is the Persian New Year. It's really just a time for everyone to come together, you know, be with people that are culturally similar to them.
Cool. How big is your organization?
It grew a lot this year.
Yeah.
We have a lot of people in like the group, our group chat, but I think like meeting to meeting, like 30 to 40 people come every time.
Okay, so Iran has been majorly in the news recently. Has that impacted your school life or your daily life at all?
So within the past, so at the beginning of this quarter, Tara and I have been reached out to by the Mustang News 2 to 3 times to give our opinions on like what's happening. So it's definitely like being talked about on our campus, and it's really cool that people want us, like want our opinions and want to get our takes on it. As far as has it affected, you know, my school life, it hasn't, because like I don't want it to. Like I'm trying not to let it, because it's easy to get caught up in all of the stuff that's happening and let it get you down. But in order to, you know, focus on my schoolwork, continue with my daily life, it's easier to just kind of keep it in the back of your mind.
Totally. The reason that I ask is that Cal Poly being such a predominantly white school, there have been so many instances or things that come up that in my reporting, people that I've spoken with from other communities say that they've often forced to be sort of representatives mm-hmm. for an issue when they're just trying to go to class.
You kind of like hit it on the nose with that. For me, the first week of school, like I didn't want to get out of bed. Like I didn't want to go to class. I didn't want to do anything. Like I love school. I love studying. Like, I know it's like a nerdy thing to say, but I love going to class. So for me, that's like very out of character. I just didn't want to do anything, because I was just such like in an existentialist point of view where I was like, what does it matter? Like, my identity is being used as a pawn, and the people in my motherland are being used as pawns in this larger political game. So it just really made me look at things differently. And a lot of times me and Tisa kind of have to be emotional support, I guess, for the rest of ISCO, because we are the heads of ISCO. Like, we're supposed to be the ones who are supposed to be strong and, you know, be there for them. But then, like, who's there for us? Like, who's there to say, like, we're here for you. We're, you know, going to be there for you emotionally. Like, anything you need, like, talk to me. Like, we're the ones saying that, but no one is mm-hmm.
saying that to us, if that makes sense. As Iranian Americans, we are sometimes looked at to be native informants almost as educators, even though that's not our role. Our role is not to educate you on this complex history of the Middle East. And that's why we actually put on this panel, because we can't answer those questions, but we know people who can. And that's why we thought it was a good idea to put it together.
First of all, congratulations on having that drive to get up and go to class every day. I want to do that. That was my opposite reaction when I went to school the first time. So tell me about this. Is it a panel? Is it a forum? What are y'all putting together and who are you bringing in?
Tara came to me week 2, I think, and was talking about how she wanted to put something on because we didn't want to just sit idly by while this was happening. And also because so many people were asking us questions about the history of conflicts between the Middle East and the U.S., we decided that we wanted to have a panel with a historian. So we have 2 history professors on this panel, Dr. Farah Al-Nakib and Dr. Sarah Bridger, who are from the Cal Poly History Department. They'll be speaking. And then in order to give, you know, a more historically accurate depiction of what's going on, the history behind the whole tensions over there.
And then we have, so it'll go historical narrative, and then a small Q&A, and then after that we have a few panelists from our club, ISCO, who will be talking about the diasporic point of view, because we really think it's important to have both the facts and how it's affecting people on campus, like why you should care. Mm-hmm. So we have 3 panelists from ISCO, including myself, talking about how this has affected Iranian Americans and our community as a whole.
And is there any of that that you want to share right now?
I think just the gist of it, which we'll obviously we'll go into depth in the panel, is just the rhetoric that's being used. So at some point when I would look in the, when I would type Iran in the news, like a week ago or like a week and a half ago, the first like 7 headlines that would come up would be terrorist blank, terrorist blank. And I think this event really like opened my eyes to seeing what the United States definition of terrorism is. Like, if you deconstruct our nationalist soapbox, terrorism can be seen as so many different things, including imperialism, including what the U.S. has been doing to the Middle East in the last decade, which is why I was just so surprised to see that the entire country, my motherland of Iran, was being referred to as a terrorist nation. How can you deem an entire nation of people a terrorist nation? Or when you say that one of the military leaders was a terrorist leader, well, when you use that kind of rhetoric, our children are going to grow up thinking about that or hearing that in schools. I thought that at least by the time my kids would grow up, some of this would be better. But it's obviously not. My brother goes to school and he's told to hide his Iranian identity. You know, he's in middle school, so he doesn't have the same knowledge or resources to speak on behalf of these complex identities. It's that type of rhetoric that just really makes us want to take action now.
Like when all of the attention was slowly like starting to arise, there's trends on Twitter and the internet of like World War III memes floating around where people were joking about being drafted in the US or like just terrible things were being said about Iran and Iranian people and how, and it was really telling, you know, because at the end of the day, if there was something like World War III, it would never touch American soil and American people would never be affected. But instead, the Iranian people would be affected. Iranian civilians would be affected. Everyday life in Iran would change. Whereas the majority of the people there don't want that. And it was just really telling and disheartening for us to see those memes.
And this event is open to people outside of the Cal Poly community? Y'all are inviting people across San Luis Obispo to come?
Yes, yeah. Definitely. We want to urge people, the locals of SLO, to come out and to, you know, just come learn with us. Because we're all learning in the end. You know, this panel is meant for education and awareness. So we really encourage locals to show.
And where and when is this going to be?
So this is January 31st, which is a Friday, from 10 to 12. It's going to be in Engineering 4, which is building 192 on Cal Poly's campus, room 106.
Now, Cal Poly, it's pretty easy to get lost on there. Is there some place that people yes. can go to find out more information about this?
the ISCO Cal Poly Facebook page. Mm-hmm. So if you just look up ISCO Cal Poly, you should see the flyer that we have about the event and updates as well.
Tara Faraji and Tisa Taranchi, thank you so much. And I hope you have a great panel on Friday.
Thank you so much.
This is Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we are joined by NPR Morning Edition co-host Steve Inskeep discussing his new book, Imperfect Union, How Jesse and John Fremont Mapped the West, Invented Celebrity, and Helped Cause the Civil War. This interview is especially pertinent to San Luis Obispo County. For example, Fremont and his troops spent time here on several occasions as they worked to help the transition from Mexican rule to California becoming a state of the Union. That's a lot of stuff. That's a huge topic. Briefly, tell us, and I know you're doing the book tour around the country, and this might be a little bit repetitive, but tell us how you became intrigued by this couple and why you think they're important for us today.
Sure. I first learned of them when I was a kid. I read books about the Old West, and I read books about the Civil War, and both Fremonts appear briefly in stories of westward expansion and in stories of the Civil War and in other kinds of books, books about American railroads. They appear again and again and again in 19th century history. They were these giant characters, and they're often referred to as being very famous and very ambitious, but never that closely studied. And as an adult writing histories and wanting to explore westward expansion, I was drawn to them for a lot of different reasons, drawn to them as a couple. John C. Fremont was this Western explorer who mapped the Oregon Trail, who went into Mexican-controlled California in the winter of 1845-46 and was involved in the process of seizing it from Mexico. And through these things, he became supremely famous. Now, the thing that I discovered was that it wasn't by accident that he became supremely famous. There were other ambitious people. There were other people who explored the West. John C. Fremont arguably didn't even discover all that much that was particularly new. Lots of other people had traveled the West before him, but he was great at publicity. And indeed, publicity was the point. He was initially sent off on these Western expeditions by his father-in-law, a powerful United States senator who wanted to encourage American settlement of the West as a way of taking it over. And in a republic, in a democracy, you couldn't order settlers to go out there. And it was a very dangerous trip to take, but you could entice them through publicity, which the senator, Thomas Hart Benton, as a former newspaper man, understood really well. And he effectively made his son-in-law the main character of this grand story of westward expansion. John would go out and have these dramatic adventures and then come back and write lyrical, beautiful reports of his adventures, which would be excerpted in newspapers and published as popular books, which people would read about while thinking about where to settle. Just to give one example, Mormons in Illinois staged a reading in a temple of sections of John C. Fremont's report when deciding to go to the Great Salt Lake area, which is an area that John had mapped.
Wow. You know, timing is everything, probably in comedy and everything else in life we can think about. But his interests, his talents came in terms of exploring the West and becoming famous at a very propitious time. Westward expansion, yeah. Manifest destiny, and so forth.
Yeah, his timing was perfect because the nation was turning its attention that way and because westward expansion had reached that moment. This is actually my second book on the topic in a way. I wrote a book called Jackson Land. It's about President Andrew Jackson and his battles with a Cherokee chief, John Ross. That was an early phase of American expansion as Indians were shoved out of the eastern United States, sometimes quite brutally, disinherited of their land and moved west of the Mississippi. The next phase was taking over the Louisiana Purchase, which the United States formally owned but little occupied, right, and getting the Pacific Coast, the Oregon Country, and California. And Fremont grew up at just the right moment as the nation was turning its attention to that. And because he was so good at publicity and because he had a lot of help from his father-in-law and his wife, Jesse Benton Fremont, who was often his kind of writing partner or secretary or editor and also his political representative and publicist in Washington, because he had that help, he was able to take advantage of his perfect timing of having grown up at just that moment.
You know, it's interesting to me reading your book and also local research I've done, his place in San Luis Obispo County history, meeting other early pioneers and camping here before he went south to take over the city of Santa Barbara, almost without a shot, I guess. But it's so interesting how a person so complex but so flawed could not only be successful but enduringly so. I mean, we still read about him today as per the topic of today, and very, very, I don't know, almost conflicted, I guess I would say, and amazing in that way.
I think that that's a fair point. He reached extraordinary heights, as did his wife, Jessie Benton Fremont, and yet because of those flaws, failed to get much higher and tarnished his image and, in fact, ended his life in relative poverty, a kind of genteel poverty, as one of his earlier biographers, one of the earlier historians described their situation. He was a guy who had trouble following orders, which is a bad thing, a bad characteristic if you are an army officer. He ultimately was court-martialed for making the wrong choice in a dispute between an army and a navy officer, both of whom were his superiors. He was someone who routinely exceeded his orders. He was someone who was persistent, as you surely had to be, to work your way over the Rocky Mountains or over the Sierra Nevada in the snow. I mean, he first got to California by going over the Sierra Nevada in February when the snowpack was unbelievably thick, as you can imagine. That took persistence. But he also, persistence can become stubbornness, and he would become stubborn about things that did not matter, or he would have difficulty changing his mind when he obviously needed to. He effectively shot himself in the foot as a general during the Civil War because he was in charge of Union forces during the Civil War in Missouri and committed an act that President Lincoln, his commander-in-chief, told him to modify or take back, and he refused to do it and ultimately was fired. He constantly undermined himself by the way that he acted, even though he did have a spectacular career.
Yes, you know, the chain of command is such a vital aspect of all of our lives, especially our working lives. But the military, it's the Bible. It's the backbone of everything. You don't countermand a superior officer, the commander-in-chief, President Lincoln. It's kind of startling, I guess, breathtaking almost. Why was Jesse Benton called the better man of the two?
There was a fellow who knew them in California, actually, in the Gold Rush days, who did say that Jesse was the better man of the two. I think he was being a little dismissive. He didn't like either of them all that much, and by complimenting her, it was a way of dissing him and saying that this nice little gentleman was overshadowed by his wife. But I think there was also a degree of respect that critic had for Jesse and that many people had for Jesse. She was the daughter of a United States senator. She was very ambitious to do things that women were not supposed to be doing in the 19th century, like practice politics, for example.
Right.
She was very well educated, thanks to her father, the senator. She ultimately found a way, while being a traditional wife and a traditional mother who respectfully referred to her husband as Mr. Fremont in letters, while doing those traditional things, she found a way to become his political advisor and political representative and have serious discussions with senators twice her age and argue with even presidents when she disagreed with them. She managed to do those adventurous things and really impressed people. At the end of their lives, or even beyond the end of their lives, when people looked back upon them, there were many people who wrote that it was fortunate that John Charles Fremont was never president. He ran for president. It was an important presidential campaign. He paved the way for Abraham Lincoln by running as the first Republican candidate for president in 1856. People, even people who'd supported him then, said it was lucky for the nation that he was never president because he was such an erratic individual. And yet they said it was unfortunate that Jessie was never first lady because she maintained her impressiveness and people even became more impressed with her over time.
That's supremely fascinating. I'd like to go back to a sort of a political angle. It seems to me that California was and always is and will be a prize of economic power, of geographic wonder and all these things. But Spain couldn't really govern it very well. It was just too far away from other Spanish establishments. Mexico ditto. There was so as much dispute in California over American rule versus Mexican rule. And yet it seems like Fremont's actions, whether it was intentional or not, cemented a concept that California was going to be a powerful part of the Union, a non-slave, by the way, that Mexico and Spain couldn't achieve in their own times.
Yeah, it's true. California was a very lightly colonized area. The vast majority of people there were natives who had lived peaceably among themselves, so far as we know, for many, many centuries before colonizers arrived. The Spanish did set up a string of missions and colonies. Mexico, as independent Mexico, then secularized the missions, as they said, and were giving land grants to various people. But there just weren't very many colonizers, weren't very many people of European descent who were there. But it was a beautiful landscape. It was an alluring landscape then, as it is now, and John C. Fremont had a grand vision for it. He borrowed this vision somewhat from his father-in-law, Senator Benton, who had long wanted a trade route to go across the continental United States to some Pacific seaport that would connect the U.S. more directly to trade with Asia,
right,
with India,
very prescient,
and with China. And Fremont's insight was to get to California and look around at the grandiose landscape of San Francisco Bay and realized this was the seaport that his father-in-law had been talking about. Fremont is the guy, as a mapmaker, who gave the name to the Golden Gate, the harbor entrance of San Francisco Bay. Now, I always thought, until I researched this book, that that name meant it was the golden entrance to the Golden State, right?
Yes.
But that's not what Fremont meant. He meant it was a golden entryway, a golden portal outward to Asia. He had this vision of what he called the commingling of the Asiatic, American, and European races, which is a remarkable thing to be saying in that quite racist time, but that was the way that he thought about the world coming together, and a lot of that vision has turned out to come true, hasn't it? I mean, he's foreshadowing the trade routes that are now at the heart of the global economy, the trade routes across the Pacific.
It kind of embodies California's own history in that it was a very diverse place in the early 1800s, and then when the gold rush came, I mean, there were people from all over the world, South America, and yet I guess I've read that, heard you say that Fremont was instrumental in making sure only white Europeans got permits to mine the gold. And so that's a very conflicted approach to life, it seems.
Oh, my gosh, yes. And a lot of people had bizarre and conflicted views of race and of issues like slavery and immigration that are hard for us to get our brains around today. Although if you think about it, sometimes we're very conflicted in our views about things. John C. Fremont can sound very progressive when we hear him say things like that commingling of the races. But yeah, when he was one of California's first two senators, he responded to the politics of the time. His constituents that he was concerned about were white voters, and they were prospectors who had just arrived recently, for the most part, in California for the gold rush. And when proposing to regulate gold mining, to bring some sense and rationality to this chaos of thousands of people digging for gold or sifting for gold in California's mountains, he proposed a bill that said you had to buy a mining permit and only United States citizens could buy the mining permits. And there is a record of a public debate in the Senate where it becomes clear that that is not some rule really about citizenship. It's about race and nationality, and excluding certain kinds of people.
White didn't privilege,
want Mexicans
probably,
to get into the mines.
So now, 150 years later, what would you, as we begin to wrap up here, what would be some enduring lessons or enduring connections between the Fremonts as a couple and their activities into today?
Well, there are so many. I mean, Fremont was a presidential candidate in 1856, which was an election in a divided nation that, when you read about it, feels a lot like today, when there were these fights about immigrants and about race and about what kind of country we wanted to be. But I want to mention something else that comes up from our discussion here, and that is the idea of the United States as a global nation. The conquest of California, in which Fremont played a confused but important role, changed America into that global nation, changed it into a Pacific power with ports facing Asia, changed it into a part of Latin America because the U.S. took over the northern portion of Latin America and the people in it.
Right.
And it made it possible for the America that we know today to be. He was involved in that, even if as a self-publicist he inflated his role.
I'm thinking that at one point, and for probably centuries, California was the western frontier, but his activities and other things of his time really changed the frontier to be global, didn't it?
Yes, absolutely. The frontier was elsewhere, and California has become a center of gravity for the United States rather than being a far-off coast.
I wonder if any of the current Democratic presidential candidates have been reading about Jesse and taking notes.
I don't know. It's possible to imagine that in a modern time, someone who was so politically attuned and ambitious would be running for office herself rather than having to operate through her husband.
Right.
But I also think there's something very modern about her story, because women today, as Jesse had to then, balance these traditional roles of wife and mother at the same time they try to figure out ways to work in careers. She had stricter rules to operate under, but women still face that same demand, that same balance, which is imposed on them or which they impose on themselves.
It's an admirable thing. I've greatly appreciated talking to you today. I've greatly enjoyed the book, especially the local connection to our own county's history. Thank you so much, Mr. Inskeep.
Thank you.
Take care. This has been Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we were joined by NPR Morning Edition co-host Steve Inskeep discussing his new book, Imperfect Union, How Jesse and John Fremont Mapped the West, Invented Celebrity, and Helped Cause the Civil War. John Fremont's name is many places in the West, including naming our local theater, the Fremont Theater in San Luis Obispo City.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian Dellinger, and I'm playing with food.
I'm just trying to enjoy a nice fermented beverage, you know?
Fermented stuff is all the rage these days. I'm not referring to beer, wine, and spirits, though those are all the rage as well. I'm referring to a lot of other foodstuffs. Playing with Food has highlighted fermented apple cider vinegar, coconut milk fermented into yogurt, and has engaged in a general conversation about the health benefits of fermented foodstuffs.
What you sipping on, DJ Dave?
That's kombucha.
What's it taste like?
Man, it's not like what you used to.
What flavor should I try?
Whatever flavor suits you.
Do they make one with ginger?
Man, that's my favorite root, bruh.
What's
favorite.
It called again?
This here? That's kombucha.
And the taste?
Like I said, man, it's not what you used to.
But one fermented product is popping up all over the Central Coast, and not just for sale, but in people's garages. And that's kombucha. This fermented tea beverage is not to be confused with the squash kabocha, but one will be forgiven if one occasionally interchanges the two words, because I do it all the time. There are several commercial kombucha brewers on the Central Coast, and many, many home brewers. To get a taste, literally, of what kombucha is, I sought out one of each, and I can honestly say that I'm a changed man. So first, follow me down to Santa Barbara.
My name's Chip Nasser, and I'm the brewery manager at Night Lizard Brewing Company.
So we're here to talk about kombucha, which I don't even know what it is, and I've never tasted it.
Oh, cool. Kombucha is a fermented tea. Primarily, kombucha, by definition, is black tea and sugar mixed together. Our product here that we make is closer to Jun, which is a Chinese beverage. It was invented 200 BC. It was named by the Japanese in around 400 AD. And the difference between Jun and kombucha is Jun is primarily green tea fermented with honey as the sugar, whereas kombucha is usually black tea fermented with like a coarse grain sugar or brown sugar, white sugar, refined sugar.
If it's fermented, is it alcoholic?
It is. Naturally, kombucha is about 0.5% to 1% alcohol by volume. In here, we make a hard kombucha, which is a 5% alcohol kombucha. We do that by blending a alcoholic base malt, a clear malt beverage, with our mother colony of probiotic kombucha that is grown using a SCOBY. A SCOBY is unique to kombucha. It's an acronym for a symbiotic colony of yeast and bacteria. That's what produces all of those beneficial probiotics, the amino acids, everything that everyone says that kombucha is good for you. Ours, we make it a little bit more of like a good for you, but you could still have a good time and get a little bit of alcohol in your system with the 5%, and we use that by blending the two together.
The acronym SCOBY is symbiotic culture of bacteria and yeast rather than yeast and bacteria. Night Lizard is a full-on microbrewery in the middle of downtown Santa Barbara on State Street, complete with a bar and food service, all together in one open space, so you will hear the workings of the brewery in the background and in the foreground. Kombucha is much easier to make than beer, and Chip took me through the process step by step.
So we have two barrels that we make our kombucha in. Both are decommissioned Cabernet Sauvignon wine barrels that are neutral. This first barrel over here is our SCOBY Mother, and this is our low alcohol. It's got about 1% alcohol inside of here. And this is a mother colony that we keep growing continuously. That white film that you see over the top, they used to call it a mushroom tea in Japan, and that's because of that floating bacteria on there, bacteria and yeast colony. And you can actually see the active yeast happening through these little holes, producing CO2 and alcohol as a byproduct.
And you can smell it as well.
Oh yeah, yeah, it's strong, almost like vinegar. And if you were to keep it going, it would get that really strong vinegar taste over. We cycled this out as we aliquot out 15, 20 gallons at a time. We then feed it with the green tea and the sugar back to keep that house culture going. And now this is adapted to both the barrel and our little bit higher alcohol that we produce in there. This barrel over here is where we make our clear malt beverage to blend with that SCOBY culture. In here, we just have a sorghum extract, which is a malt product that we then put yeast into, and it just ferments just a clear liquid up to about 7% ABV. We then blend that back with the 1% alcohol to get it down to our 5% kombucha ratio. We really are blending to tastes to get that little bit of kombucha flavor, but at the same time get you the alcohol as well. So our mother is from a local brew store here, from some people in town that were growing kombucha as a hobby, and we bought it from a commercial brewery store, grew it up. Took us about a month and a half for us to get a viable living culture in there, both because of the oak barrel, the little bit of the tannins that were in the side of that barrel from the Cabernet days, I think negatively impacted it to start off. But now it's living inside of the wood. Why the barrel is advantageous is because the whole barrel respirates. So really it provides all of that oxygen and stuff. Usually in beer, kind of want to limit the oxygen, that unless you're making a barrel aged beer, it kind of gives you that sherry note. So in our case, we want the breathability in there so that yeast really, really stays healthy and stuff like that. And we don't care if there's any byproduct on the flavor because we're blending it back with that clear malt beverage that we've done.
And it's with that mother that anyone can start their own kombucha factory.
Yeah, you could just take a little slice of that SCOBY mother, as we call it, that big mat of white. You want it to be white or flesh toned. It does turn black and die off. You don't want to get that as your culture. But you could take a little quarter size piece, throw it in a mason jar with some black or green tea that you made at home, cap it, so there's a little air exchange on there, and then you could make your own kombucha just like we made at your house.
And that's exactly what my next guest did.
My name is Garrett Olson, and I am a consultant that helps communities with strategic and emergency planning.
What does that have to do with kombucha?
Absolutely nothing, except my consulting partner, Rob, and I absolutely love kombucha in the early afternoon. Super refreshing, great flavor, good pick-me-up, super healthy. Yeah, so that's a connection to consulting. My kombucha started 15 years ago. The SCOBY is a lot like how people will treat a sourdough starter. They'll get a good starter going, and then they'll just keep propagating it over and over and over and over and over. And years down the road, they've got this great history. And so this is one that I actually got from San Luis Obispo City Manager Derek Johnson, who got it from a neighbor friend who's been growing this same SCOBY now for over 15 years. And so when I got it, you can see right now, it's maybe about 2 inches thick. It's this weird kind of fatty looking goo floating on the top of tea that was made a week ago. And when I got it, it was maybe quarter of an inch thick. And this is about my 8th batch of kombucha total. And you can see it's quadrupled in size at least. And if you give it a sniff, it smells kind of vinegary.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah. This is the kombucha that has been sitting with the SCOBY for the last 7 days, room temperature, covered with a loose cloth so it allows to off gas. And so we're going to move the SCOBY into another vessel so that we can bottle this. And then we preserve about 2 cups of the processed kombucha with the SCOBY as the starter for the fresh tea that we're going to prepare and then bottle a week from now. I am going to transfer this to the other vessel. It feels a bit like a sea anemone. It's a little slimy. You can pet the SCOBY and it will make your skin crawl.
Your SCOBY is big, about 6 inches in diameter. It's about 3 inches thick.
Scare children with it, I guess. Maybe if I could put it on my face and do Silence of the Lambs. Oh, hello, Clarice.
Wasn't there one of the Alien films where that one was suspended in water? Because that's what that looks like.
Yeah, it kind of does. I mean, it looks like a whole lot of things gross. You could take a picture from this and say, fill in the caption and you win a prize.
Yeah.
And there'd be all sorts of disgusting responses.
Well, yeah. Do you know what's in it?
Yeah, a little bit at least. It's a symbiotic culture of bacteria and yeast.
Okay. So what's it good for you?
Yeah, man, it's a beast. It detoxifies the body with an emotional release.
Wow. Where's it come from?
Originally Northeast China, but you ain't got to go that far. There's a store right behind you.
Oh, I can get some over there?
Yeah, they got what you need.
Once the all-important SCOBY is sorted out, it's time to work with the tea. You will hear, one after another, that the commercial process and the home process differ only in scale.
So we'll get the dry leaves, we'll make 31 gallons of tea. We'll pasteurize it, bring it up to 180 degrees, drop it down to about 60, 65 degrees, kick it into the barrel right there. Once it's been in that barrel, we'll add supplemental oxygen. That's really creating a hospitable environment for the yeast, and that's how we make our alcoholic side of the kombucha.
Okay.
For the mother one, we'll do one half of the strength of that alcoholic batch back to the mother. Same exact process of 31 gallons as opposed to about 1,300 grams of tea. We're going to add 700 grams of tea. We really want the mother to be not stressed. And then once both of those are finished, we then blend them back together to taste.
From the time you open the package of tea,
yep,
to the time you serve it to a customer, how long does that take?
I'd say about 14 days. So we end up making it about 2 to 3 times a month, depending on consumption.
So the normal cycle for making kombucha is about 10 days start to finish. Last night, I brewed up some tea with sugar. And so this is 21 cups of water that I brought to a boil, added 1.5 cups of sugar, and 12 black tea bags, unflavored, regular run-of-the-mill, cheapo black tea, and let them sit overnight until they came to room temperature. And that's what is in here.
Looks like...
The SCOBY will chew up most of the sugar and a lot of the caffeine. And so even those people that are pretty sensitive to caffeine and would never dream of having a cup of coffee in the afternoon, this kombucha you could drink with dinner and not have any trouble whatsoever sleeping at night. And then because it chews on a lot of the sugar, it doesn't have all of the calories that you would have if you simply made sweet tea.
Then it was all about the flavors.
So you could just bottle it with just a little bit of sugar to wake it up and make it effervescent. But I prefer this is the time when you really flavor it. So you don't flavor it when the SCOBY is floating in the tea, or you might harm the SCOBY. And you don't add flavored tea. So I enjoy Earl Grey. Earl Grey's got oils in it that they add. And so you wouldn't want to use Earl Grey. I'm super excited that we will soon have tangerines out front, because then I'll figure out, ooh, what do I pair with a tangerine? I mean, it could just be tangerine, which would be lovely, but it's always fun to just add a little something. So I hate to go back to mint again, but mint's just a nice kind of background flavor and does really well in the kombucha. So now what we're gonna do is we're gonna figure out what we want to add. And you can add so many amazing things. Google is your friend. There are millions of things you can add to kombucha. Today, what we're gonna do is lemon, ginger, and turmeric with a couple of whole peppercorns in there, because I've heard that turmeric does not have its bioavailability of inflammation reduction if it is not in an environment with pepper. So you don't really taste the pepper that much, but hopefully it makes turmeric happy for our joints. And turmeric and ginger are very complementary, kind of peppery root flavors that we really enjoy.
I mean, we do add fruit flavors to our kombucha. So the one that you tasted has a little bit of mango and key lime. We do that right at the end of fermentation, right before we put it into keg, so that the yeast and the SCOBY don't eat up those sugars and it keeps it sweet. We also have done a pineapple guava kombucha, and then also a pomegranate Schisandra berry one as well, which is pretty unique, a little bit tart and bitter. Schisandra berry is it's a very popular berry, almost like a juniper berry. It's popular in the holistic community right now. It's got a lot of unique antioxidants and stuff in it.
I'm going to add the kombucha that's been sitting for a week to the vessels. So I pour it until it just starts to approach the neck of the bottle, so I've got enough room to add the ginger turmeric juice and then the lemon. So there's enough room for it to create the CO2.
Have you ever had any of them explode?
I've heard stories of exploding ones. And the first time I made it, I slept poorly at night thinking I was gonna wake up to shards of glass and sticky sweet tea all over the garage. And so far I've been good or lucky, and which one it is, I don't care. Okay, so now we're gonna add our ginger turmeric. So this is the galoop measuring. So okay. We go, there's a galoop.
It's really specific.
Now we're gonna do lemons, half a lemon in each one. Now we're just gonna squeeze these in.
Then came the moment I was waiting for. I tasted Chip's kombucha on two different occasions, a small sip in the brewery, and then a glass shared with a friend at home.
Let me give you a sample here. And then additionally, we put a little bit of butterfly pea flour on top of here. It doesn't change the flavor at all, but it does add a little bit of amino acids and antioxidants to it. It's flavorless, but it is a pH-based color-changing liquid, so it'll turn from that indigo purple on the top of the glass to a magenta red at the bottom with the change in pH of kombucha. It's more for aesthetics than anything else.
So this is the first time I've ever tried kombucha. So describe what I'm likely to taste.
We've had people say that it's just a clean, refreshing, easy to drink summer beverage. Most people actually say this doesn't taste like other kombucha that I've had before. So it's gluten-free because of the sorghum. I mean, once you taste it, it's an easy drinker.
There's a little bit of effervescence on it. Nothing like beer.
No.
But enough to dance along the taste buds.
Definitely. What people describe as brightness of flavor over your palate when you have a little bit of that acidity from the CO2.
It doesn't taste like an alcohol pop, but it doesn't taste like alcohol.
Our bartenders are really, really great about not over-serving people and kind of keeping tabs on how many beers that they've had. Normally people come in, sit on the patio, have one or two kombuchas for the farmer's market, and then go and walk up and down there. So it's not really been a binging type beverage with us.
It is very nice. For me, for white wines, I like to find a nice, what I call a nice veranda wine. I could see this as being a veranda drink where you're sitting out on the veranda,
Yeah. Trying
to stay cool and drinking this.
Definitely, we have a lot of people take crawlers, to go and do picnics. It's a perfect beverage to be out and about, sitting on your back patio or something like that.
I'm here in my kitchen with my friend Laura.
Hello!
Have you ever had kombucha before?
Like, maybe a sip or two. I'm a little nervous.
I was the same way. Here, I'll pour you some.
Yeah, just a tiny bit.
Cheers.
Cheers.
What do you think?
Well, that's not bad. It's really clean. The stuff I had was like old tea bags or something. Do you know what I mean? Like it just was not, and I don't really like tea. Like I don't drink like straight tea anyway.
This is much nicer than that.
Take another drink.
What do you think?
It's like refreshing. It's more like a, like you would think of it in terms of like a wine spritzer. Right. Okay. Not bad.
That was the alcoholic kombucha, and then the homebrew was almost zero alcohol, and it was when I expressed sentiments similar to Laura's.
Yeah, so the kombucha we're making, and the kombucha we're going to enjoy in just a minute, is almost without a trace of alcohol, less than 0.5% ABV. You could drink it in the morning, you could drink it at night, and it tastes wonderful, and it's good for your belly. Do you want to taste?
Sure.
Okay, let's do that. So I just pour it through just a little filter. You now have a lemon, ginger, turmeric, pepper kombucha to enjoy.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Ooh, that's very pleasant.
Thank you.
So this is only the second time that I've tasted kombucha.
Oh, really?
Because I lived abroad when it became popular. And
1,500 years ago?
When it became popular in California.
Oh, okay.
Like 4 years ago.
Okay.
And I came back and visited my sister, and she pointed to a corner of her filthy dining room and said, "That's our kombucha. We love it. We make our own." And then she proceeded to describe it to me, and then other people described it to me, and it never sounded pleasant. Mm-hmm. So I just never tried it. 'Cause the description, when you try to describe what it is, I mean, you're a professional now, so you can describe it very easily in terms that people can both understand and appreciate. But when somebody who's just, you know, consumed a couple bottles wants to describe it to you, they start describing the worst thing you could ever possibly imagine drinking.
Mm-hmm. So the origins of my interest in kombucha go all the way back to July of this year.
Okay. I thought you were going to say 1,500 years ago.
No, very recently. I did a dry July, the cousin of No Booze November, and my favorite alcoholic beverage is a really good IPA. And so I was looking for something to replace that flavor profile and the sharpness of an IPA, and discovered kombucha, and was just a great replacement for an IPA with dinner. Actually, for the entire month of July, I didn't miss my IPAs. And that's why I'm still making kombucha now, is I really enjoy it, and it's just good stuff.
That was my kombucha experience, both on the commercial scale at Night Lizard in Santa Barbara and in the kitchen in San Luis Obispo. It's a simple, straightforward process, as many high-quality foodstuffs are. And for the adventurous who have only had someone like Chip make your kombucha, don't be too intimidated.
You said you've done beer. It seems a lot simpler than home brewing beer.
Holy smokes, it's a lot simpler than brewing beer. If you've made beer, making kombucha is the easiest thing in the world. And if you haven't made beer before, making kombucha is still pretty darn easy. Anybody can do it. So just find a friend that has a SCOBY and ask them to tear you off a bit of their SCOBY with a little bit of their unflavored kombucha starter and go to town. Short of adding your tea too hot to your SCOBY, you really can't mess it up. It's a pretty forgiving process. And beer is not always as non-temperamental.
Mmm. Very tasty, very refreshing.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah. And no alcohol.
And no alcohol.
And very little caffeine and very little sugar, but lots of flavor.
If I'm awake all night, I'm coming after you.
With or without alcohol, you may enjoy this refreshing drink with ancient roots that is reimagined every day here on the Central Coast. This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian, and I'm playing with food.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Today is the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. An estimated 1.3 million people were sent to the German Nazi concentration camp. 1.1 million died. 960,000 were Jews. It was the largest extermination camp run by Nazi Germany in occupied Poland during World War II. The Soviet Army liberated Auschwitz 75 years ago, on January 27, 1945. Last week, Central Coast resident Bob Cam was a guest on Dave Congleton Hometown Radio. Cam is 43 years old, lives in Los Osos, is Jewish, and a poet. He says he can only trace his ancestors back two generations, and says he believes any Jewish person, whether they are religious or not, likely feels a connection to the Holocaust. To commemorate the anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, Cam read a poem on Congleton's show last week, which we are going to rebroadcast today. The title is Ellie and the Blue Volvo, and it will appear in his next collection of poetry, The Magic Hour, due out later this spring. Here is Bob Cam reading Ellie and the Blue Volvo.
We were taking him from the airport to speak at a luncheon in downtown Cleveland. His presence in the backseat of my mother's blue Volvo sedan was at once weightless and ponderous. His name was Elie Wiesel. My cousin Danny sat beside him, chatting quietly. He was a student of Elie's, working his way through the Jewish holy books. He called Elie rabbi, teacher, and it was Danny who had arranged for today's speech. I sat in the front next to my mother, my body turned so I could study Elie, although he wasn't the first person I'd met who'd survived Hitler's savagery. I'd been to Israel for nearly 2 years in the late 60s and early 70s. It was commonplace in those days to see people on buses in short-sleeved shirts with concentration camp numbers tattooed on their forearms. And then there was 40-something Chaim on the Galilean kibbutz, the communal farm where I was living. Chaim was called Chaimki, little Chaim, because he was barely 5 feet tall, though stout and surprisingly strong. His domain was the lul with chickens, where he would throw heavy bags of feed over his shoulder and chat with his creatures in barely audible Yiddish. Chaimke had a number on his arm, but he did not wear his nightmare or his survival on his sleeve, though he certainly had a story, which he would tell, if asked in a soft way, with respect, at the right moment, usually while tending his newly hatched chicks. He had escaped from Auschwitz twice at the age of 15, the second time for good, snatched from the darkness and the rabid Nazi fire by a Polish family, hidden till the end of the war. Escaping for good, to come to Israel, to marry, have a daughter, name her Devorah, raise chickens, live a quiet life under the Jewish night, for good, and tell his story from time to time, when asked in a soft way, with respect, in a moment when the air was still, when, for reasons I would never know, he could stand to recall the images, the feelings, the terror of being shot and falling into a ditch beneath so many other machine-gunned Jews, only to discover he was alive, the bullet having passed through the flesh above his hip. And so, in darkness, he climbed from the gash in the ground filled with bodies, a gash that was not to be covered over until morning, so much for German efficiency. He climbed out from under the dead who had saved his life, climbed out and tunneled under the fence like a furious dog, ran for the woods and a flickering light, with a pounding wish for shelter, for kindness, for life. Escape that place for good, that place for which there were no words to describe the smell of fear and sweat and last breaths, no words for dead eyes fixed on a godless sky. He would tell this story, sometimes while tending his chicks, if asked in a soft voice, with respect and hesitancy, but a yearning to know. Tell it with wonder on his face, as if he still couldn't believe nearly 3 decades later that the world had grown claws and fangs and hungered for Jewish blood, and still couldn't believe he had actually escaped that land that dwelled so far beyond the frontiers of terror and desperation. But mostly, Chaimke just lived, with energy, even effervescence, and talked about his daughter, or his wife, or the beauty of the kibbutz community, or the best feed for his chicks, or how many stars you could see on a moonless night here in the Jewish land. But Ellie, in the back seat of my mother's blue Volvo sedan, Ellie was different. He wore a long-sleeved shirt, jacket, and tie, his numbered arm hidden, but only his arm, not his anguish. Cavernous anguish, in the lines descending from the corners of his nose. Cavernous anguish, in the lines between his eyebrows and in his dark pupils. Cavernous anguish, like the gaping mouths of the dead, filled with night and fire. For though he was also 15 when captive, he had not escaped like Chaimke, but had suffered the claws, the fangs, the hunger for Jewish blood at Auschwitz and Buchenwald, where his father had withered into death. And then, beyond all hope, Ellie had been liberated before a gash in the ground or a gas chamber or machine gun, rifle butt or bayonet, dysentery or starvation could end him. At the luncheon, he rose to speak, and I might have been forgiven for expecting the thunderous voice of God to blast from his lips for all he had experienced and witnessed. But that was not Ellie. Soft tones, sometimes barely audible, flowed from him like hot honey. But within his voice, riding a wet dark wind from far behind him, came many voices, voices within voices, all audible, voices within voices, anguish within anguish, filling every inch of the ballroom. His mission, to speak for those who endured the unspeakable and could not tell their stories. And the warning implicit in them that this could happen again, though it might look different. But the human race has not been inoculated from this rampaging disease of cruelty. His mission filling the room, dark wind, dark waters rushing in until all of us, the audience, the servers and busboys, all of us were gasping for air, tears etching our cheeks like streaks of ash from a falling sky. On the way back to the airport, once again, Cousin Danny sat with Ellie in the back seat of my mother's blue Volvo. I sat in the front, turned so I could see him. His face transfixed me. Danny once again addressed him as Rabbi and asked a question about a Talmudic passage. Ellie answered him with patience and affection in his soft, near-whispering voice. I was astonished he could travel in a matter of minutes from the incomprehensible murders of Auschwitz and Buchenwald to the back seat of the Volvo to answer my cousin's question. And I thought, his heart has been shattered. Shattered. And still, he loves. How is that possible? It has been nearly 50 years since that day. Ellie is gone. My mother is gone. Her blue Volvo is long gone. And yet recently, I have seen them. Ellie, Mom, the Volvo. As I've seen stories of entire people exiled from their land. Stories of parents and children treated as parasites, separated and caged. Stories of bullets spraying through malls, open-air markets, weddings, nightclubs, concerts, schools, churches, synagogues. The rapacity of the Nazis returning, only clothed differently and media savvy. And I have seen them floating through images of the Amazon screaming, the glaciers screaming, the coral screaming, hurricanes, tornadoes, and droughts screaming, whole species vanishing, everywhere throats full of rage amidst the stupid, deaf malevolence of mankind against itself and everything around it. Images of a world that cannot be escaped for a greater good, as Heimke had from Auschwitz. I see the blue Volvo floating by like a ghost ship in the middle of these stories, my mom behind the wheel, and Ellie in the back seat, gazing through the window, eyes so forlorn and yet so compassionate, hands pressed against the glass, his anguished lips moving, but his words inaudible for all the screaming in the world. My body bends toward him, yearning for his voice and the voices within his voice and the stories that might teach us, make us better against all odds. I tremble for humanity, run to an empty beach as far from the screaming images as possible. I scan the blue skies for glimpses of God and find only absence and silence. But here, on this beach, at least I can remember. I can remember being in the front seat of my mother's blue Volvo on the way to the Cleveland airport, transfixed by Ellie, who has traveled from Auschwitz and Buchenwald in a matter of moments, as he answers my cousin's questions with such patience, such warmth. And I can remember thinking, as if it were happening right now, his heart has been shattered, shattered, and still he loves. How is that possible? How is that possible?
That was Bob Kamm reading Ellie and the Blue Volvo on the Dave Congleton Show to commemorate the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. This is Issues and Ideas. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all of our guests and contributors this week. I'm Tyler Pratt. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or listen to past segments. It's all at kcbx.org.